circumstances sometimes are unforeseen. What was unforeseen are these photographs. Since I was asked to address a question regarding life more than 50 years ago in Pasadena area, perhaps from the point of view of a student as distinct from Mr. Armstrong, I would like you at least to think, if you have questions, to bring them up. I have been asked, if it was suitable, on a second weekend of the next month, December, to speak in Altadena on the topic again. That is essentially what I've been asked to do, is to give a kind of background that would help many who have come years later, and sometimes decades later, to understand the impact and what relationship the institution that is now being marketed in Pasadena bore to the world, to the then Radio Church of God, because we were using radio as a means of communication, and let us say to the parent church. The mother church was Eugene, Oregon. At that time, that was headquarters as well. But in reality, Pasadena developed as a headquarters church over time. Certainly, there was a great feeling of contact with the Eugene Church, and many students stopped there in those early days. Now, what has been given here, I would like to at least comment on. I have appreciated that Mr. Ron Guisado is not only whom you think he is, he's also a sleuth. That is, one who acquires things and knowing where to get them, very appreciative of seeing it. And I thought he might like to, if it's possible, to come up here, and then we can discuss together. You can tell us a little bit about some of the photographs. One clearly is at a point in time that simply is different from the layout today, wherever it's convenient. And then we can go from there, but that means that you can have photographs here. You can pull a chair up, that's fine, that you can see later. I first would like to thank Mr. Ronald Guisado for the courtesy of bringing them. I do know that these historic photos of Pasadena are available. There have been publications. One was officially done a number of years ago on the history of Pasadena, which is quite remarkable. And then individuals have done, I've known, two brochures since. I acquired one unexpectedly, the original one that was done on behalf of the city of Pasadena. But that was really a history unrelated to Ambassador College, so I didn't focus on it. Would you like to comment how these were obtained? And we can discuss what we may know of it, and then you can take a look afterward. First of all, I would like to just address the question in your mind that you understand that the story of Ambassador starts essentially with an idea in 1946, and it developed. And the solutions for starting it were basically arrived at by the summer of 1947. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote an autobiography, Volume 1, which I would regard as very valuable for the broad responsibilities of the church. But Volume 2 does tell us a lot about Ambassador College. I personally recommend Volume 1 as something not to be overlooked, because it has to do with administration of the church and how things were practiced. Anyway, those two should be available, and I could tell you that I have a number of copies of the autobiography, volumes 1 and 2, an unknown number, but I'm in possession also of numerous boxes, not scores, of The Envoy or other publications later that the foundation did, because there was a time that shipping and receiving said they didn't have room, and these volumes would either not be, or they had to have storage elsewhere, and my wife and I still walk around them in some cases. I do know that those that were retained have of recent date been disposed of, certain things, I don't even know exactly which ones, but I do have any number of the better envoys of the later period, which would have meaning in terms of the worldwide work as distinct from merely the students who were there in the earliest days. And I would suggest you do not forget the February 1947 edition of The Plain Truth if you ever have a chance. That was the first public presentation. In fact, that was the first issue of The Plain Truth that I obtained after I got a job working on a chicken ranch in Northern California. After I graduated from high school, I worked for the equivalent of 1 year. And that came in the mail, which was, of course, a remarkable, I would say, a kind of romantic dream. I mean, he knew how to present it in photographs, if you've ever seen it. And the story of that there would be a college was introduced in the December 1946 co-worker letter. It happened to be that I got a job Sunday taking care of the ranch, and on Monday that co-worker letter arrived. I mean, the unusual feeling that step by step something was happening. Would you like to give the background of the photographs without passing them around yet?
Certainly. Basically, the photographs come from the church's historical records that they have. And I acquired them recognizing that there might be some significant changes that would be occurring and wanting to make sure that at least I had some copies of things that I have a personal interest in terms of the history of the college. So I had some copies made. This was back about 1995. And these photographs date from approximately 1946 aerial shots basically of the campus up till about the mid-60s. And all of them kind of give you a sense of not only the development of the college, but the development of Pasadena. You can see where the present freeway goes through, but at that time there were beautiful homes. You can see there's a lot of open land off of Orange Grove Boulevard, which were part of the old mansions. So that's basically
numerous trees.
Yes.
That's remarkable, and the earliest one of the later 40s.
So that's basically the background and the history and what they are.
Thank you.
And
we don't have to go over them now. Let me say that we can place them on a table or somewhere, and you have to know that some are oriented looking north, some looking east, some looking essentially west. And the tennis court you see is the old tennis court that we developed where there had been a camellia nursery, which is why Ambassador had so many camellias around, because this was a camellia nursery. And these camellias at Ambassador College and then the university are old varieties, those that would have been marketed no later than around the 1950s. So, and many of them were large. That gives you some idea. The world has made some nice contributions since, but many of those old varieties are unavailable. let me explain, just to start with, then there may be questions you would like to ask. What we are doing in a small group out of the Canoga Park Church, this small group meets in a home here in Sunland, is going through the book of Acts. And the most remarkable thing, when we go through it verse by verse, chapter by chapter, I haven't invited anyone from Pasadena, even though many of you, few of you rather, live extremely close. If any of you wish to, you could always, let's say, give me a call, and I would let them know if there are other guests. I haven't tried to integrate any brethren in this area that live either in the Canoga Park or the Pasadena area, because we split in different directions. But going through the book of Acts up to the point that we finished, which happened to be chapter 15, the geography, which is what I would like to address, the geography of the church at that time is so completely different from the world today that you really have to ask yourself, what has happened in the last 1970, 80 years? Just to illustrate a point, the focus is on Jerusalem to start with, just as the city of good birth, Eugene, Oregon, is where many brethren of the Church of God were. Now, the one thing that was remarkable is that the bulk of the people in our group didn't know why people went down from Jerusalem and up to Jerusalem who hadn't been there. Because we use the words down and up often in reference to north or south. So it is very easy to mistake the world and to misinterpret it on the basis of what our experience might be years later. Therefore, looking at, let me just comment briefly, there is both the geography, then there is the world around, and the church moves north along the coast of what was Syro-Phoenicia, that is modern Syria and Lebanon, Cyprus, this island, then southern Asia Minor, which we would associate with the country Turkey. But I'm saying this for a reason. I'll be leading up to it. When you look at that, you ask yourself, well, why is all this area a kind of Greek area, when today Cyprus is divided between Turks and Greeks, when Syria, and a Semitic-speaking country, Lebanon, a Semitic-speaking country, is again going back to the Semitic language, as once there had been Aramaic before the Greek. See, the Greek world came in as Hebrew became more and more like, we know, Aramaic. Then you have your Greek and Roman world, and once more you have the people who speak Arabic, a Semitic language dominant there. And nobody speaks of Turks in that day in Asia Minor or Cyprus. All that is new. And the remarkable thing is that you had a whole area belonging to an empire out of Italy that came to be Christianized and centuries later in the East attacked. It collapsed in the West. We're not bothering with that. It was attacked and held its ground for practically 1,000 years longer than the empire held Rome. Rome, we traditionally say, fell in 476. The French would have another date. It depends on how they look at what we mean by the fall of Rome. It passed to other people than Romans. But the Constantinople, now called Istanbul, fell in 14 not 400, but 1453, practically 1,000 years later, to the Turks. And the bulk of the Greeks that had not departed, in fact, were still living in Western Asia Minor until after World War I, when the Greek Republic essentially sent all Greeks into exile who had been in Asia Minor. Now, that is such a different story, so that when we look at the map today, several of our brethren, who are knowledgeable about the world, simply had no grasp of how different things were then in comparison with what they are now in that part of the world. So let me go back. Ambassador College had no reason for being without something happening in Oregon. Now, why it had to be Oregon is a question that I think I can describe, having lived only on the West Coast, as distinct from somewhere else. So I'm rather knowledgeable in terms of, since my father came before 1890 as a child. My mother was born in Los Angeles the same year Mr. Armstrong was born. And to give you a feel of what's happened, she was born in a residential area we call Main Street in Los Angeles. If you know where Main is, that was all residential. Los Angeles was a town of some significance in those earlier days of this state. Pasadena was not founded until the last quarter of the 19th century. Then it became a real community from people who were, to a great extent, from Iowa. Now, California gradually developed with two centers, one around the Bay region and the other around Southern California. But Southern California could not have developed without water. And the Bay region could only develop by expanding land into water, as happened in the San Francisco Bay. It was the reverse down here, so it was much later in developing. And many of you who know something of the history of the American West will remember that one of the great routes to the West was called the Oregon Trail. It happens to have been easier to get to Oregon than it was to get to California. The Sierra Nevadas present a greater problem for the state of California as we think of it as a geographic area. The story of the Donner Pass and the cannibalism. You have the Great Desert, whereas you have a more hospitable route, however long it might have taken, to the Oregon Trail. Historically, Oregon was developed comparatively early as the Bay region also in this state. But in a sense, it is important to realize that there were, in both states, very important valleys. California had a huge one, and without a question, would have brought numerous people. No insignificant number of people came from the area of the Dust Bowl. But what was unusual, as background for you, the largest number of people who suffered from the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, and my wife can tell you about that, I believe from her point of view in the panhandle of Texas, 1931, then 1933, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 represent the 7 years. There was 1 year it was not as serious, and it wasn't a straight seven. But it was centered in the area of Oklahoma, Missouri, northern Texas. It affected parts of Kansas without a question, and eastern Colorado, and extended practically to the Canadian border. But the heartland, you could say, was springing out of the region of Oklahoma as probably the center, interestingly, of it. And Missouri was affected. Now, the headquarters of the Church of God, Seventh Day, was in what state? Who will tell me? Yes, Missouri. The headquarters was in a state which was seriously affected by the drought of the 1930s. And a significant number of people of the Church of God tended to gravitate to the area where the headquarters was, at Stanbury, Missouri. And many of them were in Oklahoma, a land that was opened up fundamentally after World War I. In terms of my wife's father, homesteaded, I'll let her tell that story, homesteaded. He was born essentially, 1 year later than Herbert Armstrong, 93? Yeah. So you were dealing with people who could homestead the two states, Arizona and Oklahoma, were the last in the contiguous 48 to join the Union. California became a state of the Union already before the Civil War. Oklahoma had to wait much longer. But that was Indian territory. So many of the brethren that started out in Rhode Island went to West Virginia. None of the brethren in the Church of God Seventh Day that we have any knowledge of lived in a Confederate state. None of them did. They lived in a state that was a part of the Confederacy that broke up. They lived in the west of Virginia, and therefore in West Virginia. So the Church of God Seventh Day was not by any means a Yankee church, because many of these people simply had moved out of the land of the Yankees in New England and settled west in Appalachia and westward toward the Mississippi. They tended to be small town people, whereas the Seventh-day Baptists tended to stay in Appalachia and eastward and north toward Michigan. The Church of God Seventh Day tended to be a people from West Virginia to the Mississippi and then to Oklahoma as settlements were possible. One footnote. You know that Texas has a panhandle that really extends north. Oklahoma has a panhandle that extends west. That Oklahoma panhandle, just to give you an idea, was so wild and untamed, and Native Americans dominated it, that when Texas became a state of the Union, they did not want to include the northern end of that panhandle region, which was called no man's land. And it passed to Oklahoma. So you see how, I'm giving some background that many of you might know if you've lived there, whatever the background may be. Mr. Cornell Smith, by the way, is he's from Muskogee, Oklahoma, who is the person who facilitates our small group in the Zegers residence. The Church of God Seventh Day also had people who, as Mr. Armstrong did before the Great Drought, there were people who were moving westward into California and Oregon. not exclusively those states, but that was clearly a land of opportunity, without a doubt. Mr. Armstrong tells me something. Even though many people of Iowa were coming to Pasadena in Southern California, there were other people from Iowa, such as himself, who thought of Oregon. That is, the concept that California was the only place was not true. Gold was finished as far as making money. But Oregon had some remarkable farmland, just as California did, and was far more likely to be developed by newcomers. Oregon was easily early settled because of the famous Oregon Trail, but California was settled also early in the northern part, and so early that the bulk of the people who ultimately made money in this state owned land and owned large tracts, people who quickly understood from Europe, Italians, Portuguese, Irish, Germans, Swiss, that those who panned for gold also needed to eat. And there was far more gold in chickens and cattle and fruit trees and vegetables and grain. And so California came to be highly developed early agriculturally, and in the 1890s was the nation's leading producer of wheat. It was early developed, and the earlier it's developed, the more likely you will have less land available in terms of farming. The bulk of the people that I grew up with came to Northern California in my lifetime while I was there, while Mr. Armstrong and family were in Oregon. They came early in the 1900s or the last century. I have to change that shortly. because gold attracted many people, and therefore it was an area in which people as a whole didn't have the same opportunities to put down new roots agriculturally as many were able to do in Oregon at a later time. I think also we have to realize the climate would affect the kind of production. California allows for the greater development of certain crops. Oregon simply was a truck gardening state far more than California was, though we still are the greatest truck gardening state of the Union, but there's so many other things that we produce. But many brethren went to Oregon in the Church of God, Seventh Day, as they came, but California is so much larger, and if half went up there and half went here, the half that went to California were scattered in a very large state. The half that would have gone to Oregon were scattered essentially from the border of the south to Portland in a valley in the western half, and it was a much smaller region. And indeed, there were a significant number of people. The most remarkable thing, I had never heard of the Church of God Seventh Day. Actually, never heard of it before I came to Ambassador in 1947. For people in the East Coast, the Midwest, it might have been different, but I don't think my wife had ever heard of them either. But when I got to Oregon, I found that practically every place, members of the Church of God Seventh Day were widely known in the farming small town communities throughout the Willamette Valley. It was really remarkable. So different. Now, why I'm mentioning this is even though the Church of God Seventh Day had members scattered in California, the impact of the church was far greater in Oregon than it was down here. Oregon did not have, to my knowledge, nearly the Catholic population that you had here. The Italians, the Bavarians, Spanish-speaking people, the Portuguese, and many Irish from Ireland. There are other kinds of Irish. It represented a Catholic population, and the bulk of Oregon was not quite like that at all, from my experience. Doesn't mean there is not an important Catholic community, but California, Northern California, where I grew up, was, in fact, predominantly Catholic in the schools. So I had Catholic friends, numerous of them. Now, when you add Mr. Armstrong's skills to the church began to develop clearly in Oregon, as the autobiography will tell you that Mr. Armstrong wrote, with respect to radio. And I don't want to go into the origin of radio. Most of you would realize the impact was beginning to be felt in the 1920s and came to be significant early in the 30s at prices that now are incomprehensible, simply incomprehensible. But as time went on, it was quite clear that Southern California was going to supersede Northern California in terms of, shall we call it, the leading city of trade in what has turned out to be the Pacific Rim. That is, the most important city. If you start from Australia and go northwest, then you think of Japan, then you think of the United States, and go down to Chile. The most important city in the midst of that ocean or along its borders is the greater Los Angeles area, Los Angeles, Long Beach. This is the ultimate center of trade. It goes in and out. That's how the bulk of trade comes in the United States, from the Pacific. That became important because after World War II was over, 1945, in Asia in August, it had ceased in May, April, May, in Europe. Then it became apparent also that there were two areas of the world in which telecommunications would develop. One was New York. Nobody denies its primary role yet. The other turned out to be in connection with an entirely different industry. We call it Hollywood. Hollywood, not Los Angeles, but Hollywood in Los Angeles, made Los Angeles a new center for communication. If there was to be any other city outside of New York, it would have to be the greater Los Angeles area, and Hollywood is a part of Los Angeles. And that is why Mr. Armstrong focused on this area, because there was no such development, and never would be in the present age, in Seattle, Tacoma, or Portland, or Eugene. And as it turned out, San Francisco has had a long history in terms of the importance of some broadcasting, but you can't have two cities both equal. Los Angeles came late, but because we had the capacity to bring water, we could spread and spread and spread. In the state of California, we have the largest county in the nation. We also have a county that is the city, It is called San Francisco County. That city, San Francisco, has nowhere to go unless it builds a little land in the bay. San Francisco has nowhere to go. It cannot continue to grow. And you have to understand that as to why the shift was down here and why it was so late in developing, because without the water, we passed from a coastal desert to essentially pasture land, to grain, and then to fruit trees, and finally to Wilshire Boulevard. I came just as Wilshire Boulevard was beginning to be developed. I came to Ambassador when there were no apartments along South Orange Grove, only residences. In that first year and into the second, we had visitors, and I would walk the visitors up and down Orange Grove. They had never seen anything like it. These remarkable estates, all of which, except at the end where Ambassador College developed, are gone. I can't describe them. My wife came in the fourth year, 1950, and she will remember how many still were there. I think you would say that. But they just gradually disappeared. When you live here, there are some things that you remember, and then there are other things that escape, and you take for granted that everything seems to have just gradually shifted, and you don't necessarily, except maybe in one building or one spot, notice the development that really impacts you. But you have to realize, let me cite, that we had an area called Grove Street. You all know where Grove Street is. Is there anyone who doesn't? I think Grove Street was. Grove Street, when I came, was where you see the number 363 at the entry to the library building. That address was 363. Grove Street. That was an important street, and at the area that we would now call St. John, I think that's the one going north and south, west of the present freeway, as you approached Del Mar and going through Grove Street area, there was a rail station. And there was a family there. It wasn't an important rail station anymore. It was for freight. It was different from the railroad that paralleled Raymond for passengers. But when I was there, a family had a large piece of property by it. I am not sure whether they were white or black, on honesty, at this point, because I didn't always know who lived in what house. But the one thing they did have was goats. And they had grass. And they had weeds. I would walk that first year when I came, when the present library building was, and the carriage house also, the center of the campus. That's all we had was that. I would walk on Green Street, and the present nearing demolition center between Green and Colorado, the mall that was developed and has proved to be the wrong idea for Pasadena, sadly. I didn't even realize how it had deteriorated in the last half a decade. When I would go down Green Street, fully half of all the blocks from our property all the way to Lake had weeds, no homes. They just were owned by somebody who didn't live there. It was simply completely undeveloped. Pasadena had one main street, Colorado, going east and west. The population hasn't changed. We had practically no blacks in this community of Pasadena until World War II, when there was employment available, because so many young people went into the army. And many of these people who came in lived in very small homes by comparison to those on Orange Grove. So the population was as large when I came as it is today. It's essentially stable. It was around 125,000. What has happened is that many of these small homes, single-family homes, scattered all over the community have disappeared now in the experience of Ambassador. And in its place have gone up the gated communities, wealthy or otherwise. You see, this is what's happened. And business is so different today. When you consider that all the business you needed was along then a decaying Fair Oaks. When I came, it was already headed down, and Lake hadn't been discovered, except by one strange business called Bullock's. When I first saw Bullock's store, it was surrounded by a parking lot and what was nothing more that I would call pasture. It was all by itself. Somebody had to start, and they had the vision that that was the next major street, because Fair Oaks was losing its quality. It was losing its quality. Many people from the South, you see, the blacks who were coming in to work in the homes of the wealthy on the west side, that somehow pushed the development of the city eastward. And Pasadena has spread east, and then it spread south at the same time. So that I could tell you practically every building that was, I could tell you which ones were there when I came, and all the rest are new. And there were many that were there on the north side of Green Street that are all gone, been replaced by the mall. Some very nice Spanish-style buildings were on Green Street then. There were not very many cars. I came in 1947. The first new cars after World War II was over were built after factories were repaired from 45 into 48. The factories were being repaired. I came down in late September of 1948 to begin the second year, or mid-September, let's say. And the new cars were out, essentially what we would call the 49 model. There was traffic in 1 year's time that had doubled. If I were to describe, it was like saying twice as many cars had come on the streets at the beginning, and they were not here in end of May, early June. They were really bought up and came on the streets in the summer of 1948, after I had returned home to Northern California. And then you should have seen the long, long lines. The Pasadena Freeway was built for people who went 25 to 40 miles an hour. That was why you have 5 to 10 mile an hour exits and entries. Built in the later 30s. And from 1948 on, you would take the freeway to Los Angeles, and what you entered as you were leaving Pasadena, it wasn't very long, you entered into the neck of a bottle. And it was, for years, the traffic problem was serious because the cars came before the freeways. The freeways really did not become the arteries that we now know them to be until the later 1950s, because normally, as students, we would take the red car. That's the, you know, the streetcar, the trolley, that we have Henry Huntington to thank. And we had approximately, my wife did not have that much. She, if I say we had 10 years, she had essentially 7 years where she would remember the streetcars. The short line was at Fair Oaks, south to Los Angeles. The long line, Colorado, east, essentially Lake Street, south, Oak Knoll, and then going down to Los Angeles. That was the long route. That was a different world. It was a world in which, when I was from time to time in the public library, Mr. Armstrong guessed where I was when I wasn't on the campus, the librarian would get a ring. And she'd go from room to room saying, somebody by my name, and I'd identify myself, a Herbert W. Armstrong wishes to speak with you. That didn't happen later. It was a different kind of community. It was as large, but it was a different psychology. And one of the things my wife can tell you, as some of you may have discovered, depending on when you came, Grove Street was very difficult for taxis to find. Do you want to explain anything there? Did your taxi driver know where Grove Street was?
No, he didn't. I got to Pasadena from Los Angeles on the rent car about 10 o'clock at night. And I got off there at the street corner, and there were about three taximen there. So I chose one, and I told him where I wanted to go. Actually, I told him 182 South Orange Grove.
Yes, which had become an address.
Yes, and he drove around there for about 5 or 10 minutes and couldn't find it. And finally, he advised me to go to the YWCA. Mm-hmm. And so I went there and stayed there in a little room for a dollar. And the next day, I walked around myself, and I couldn't find it. And we finally did find
363 Grove
Street.
Yeah.
Was it
smoggy
that day?
No. Which brings up another question. When I came that first year, it was amazing how clean the air was, 47 to 48. 48 to 49 was not that big of a problem. I can't say what it was like between 49 and 50, but, you know, things begin to change with the automobile. But in the period of time from 1950 to late 1950, which I would say would be approximately 1956-58, in that time period, smog developed to such an extent that you could look out the window on the south side of Mayfair. And you could hardly see the outline of the library building across the old tennis court. It was unbelievable. Do not blame the automobile for all of it. Industry had its role. In my judgment, there's something else that in our area was the biggest problem. Mr. Scott, would you like to speak up?
Well, I lived in Eagle Rock in the 1950s, and I remember they banned outdoor trash burning. That was about 1957.
That was it.
Earlier. Also, that was probably about the time when the streetcar went away, because
yes.
I remember taking the streetcar from Eagle Rock going into Los Angeles from time to time when I was a kid.
Yes.
You're right. Smog was pretty bad back in the 50s. They did a remarkable job of cleaning it up.
Yeah.
Even with the increase of traffic and population.
Yes. The backyard burning. Somehow, people didn't know how to get the proper draft. You see, trash was in general burned in the backyard.
It wasn't collected.
Some trash was collected, but I don't... so much paper, things like that. You perhaps sent off garbage of another sort. But people simply burned in the backyard the trash that would be burnable. Every morning you could see the smoke going up, and finally you couldn't see anymore where it was coming from. And the arrival of the automobile at that high point when the red car disappeared and the backyard burning, that all took place from the middle to the slightly later half of the 1950s. And it took a long time to deal with the problem, but that's the high point of it. I do not think that the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s ever saw anything as bad as the 1950s. It was moving more impressively in a positive manner.
I do recall in 65 when I came out of the States, I was driving down Cajon Pass, it was in October, and you could see nothing but a brown cloud.
Yeah.
There was nothing
yeah.
you could see through it. And I almost was tempted to go back, but I was coming out here because of the church and because
yeah.
of the job market.
Yeah.
And even then, it was pretty bad.
Yes, it was. My description of it is not untrue when I say that the small distance between those two buildings made one practically invisible from the other. That's how serious it was.
Yeah, I think so. I know I stayed back in 65.
This is Hopkinson speaking.
Right. And I can remember coming out of the library building. And this was early October. Right. You could barely see the old carriage house from the library into that. It was just like such a dense yellow haze. It was just like a thick fog.
What year was that in your mind?
That was the summer. That was October of 65.
65.
65.
65.
And that was
yeah.
about seaside. And there were a few of us stayed back. We were working, and it was so thick that you walked out of
yeah.
the library building and it was just like a dense fog. You just could barely make out the carriage house from the library set.
One would say that probably it was a full decade of very, very serious problems on that basis. I wanted to touch on some of this background to give you a feeling of some kinds of problems that we have in our time, because I would like to break the thought here and go back to Judea. One of the most remarkable things that I notice in the New Testament is the level of illness in the people of the land. How many needed to be healed? And then to consider the high point of building that is attributed to Herod's such as the city of Caesarea, named after Caesar, that is, Augustus. Is there a parallel between such a remarkable ability to build great communities, such as we had in Judea and further north and Syria, and in fact places that even today in Syria and Lebanon are not inhabited? You simply go by these regions. Then I had to realize that some of the answer is very possible. We had our smog and lung problem. They had a different problem, different kinds of illnesses. Though the Roman Empire later had a lot of smog problems because it burned so much wood, which I won't touch on now. How did Herod design the removal of waste, human waste? He built channels, pipes, such that the Mediterranean would rise and actually fill the pipes. And then, as the tide went down, it carried away what had been accumulated without any treatment whatsoever. And you can be sure once the whole coast has this kind of thing, as you have had under the communists at Yalta, we saw the same, they didn't have the same skills, they just simply drained it directly in the Black Sea. But I have to realize that civilization, the civilization that we've had to live through here, has not been a beautiful one in those first, let's say, 20 years of Ambassador, from the late 40s to the late 60s. But it wasn't a pleasant situation. They did not know how to do it because they were not actually following the principle that if you turn human waste back to the soil, it should be decomposed there. And there are many ways now, and let me tell you that the first institution in the United States to respond to Eric Aveson, who is Swedish, who developed the concept of composting waste. Was the Worldwide Church of God and Ambassador College. We were the first ones to put money where our mouth was and to enable him to develop the experimental role, and his article appeared in The Plain Truth. We were, I would say that was where the mind of the church really was in helping to resolve the world around. To say we have never done anything, you know, adequate, that we didn't reach out, that would be to say you weren't here in the days when we reached out in that way. We have never been unable to reach out to communities. When I came into the fellowship of the Worldwide Church of God, I found in Oregon and down here a people who had not forgotten that there is such a thing as natural. Been the kind of subject that many people attacked. You cannot imagine the ignorance in the field of medicine as late as the 1920s and 30s. Medicine, what you know today, was a direct result not of World War I, but of World War II. The shock was there of World War I. How to resolve it didn't come until World War II. And in between, there was a tendency of doctors to, and socially there was. It was the high point of no alcohol were in, I lived in a part of this country, I won't speak for every part, in which I saw piano legs covered with cloth so that nobody could be reminded that when you saw a piano leg, that you might have thought a woman had legs. She had limbs. This was the state of mind in the 1920s and 1930s. And at the same time, nursing babies was thought to be unsanitary. And thank God that the United Nations stopped the United States from imposing that idea on the whole of the developing world. Because we didn't know, didn't even think through, that when you send powdered milk, what liquid are you going to use to turn it into a milk drinkable product? It was far better to be unsanitarily nursed by a mother than to have to take the water where you, on one side of the lake or stream, wash your clothing, and on the other side, the green algae where human waste was dumped. If you don't know what the third world is like, you haven't seen it. So we had a remarkable thing. Not only were we interested, I'm speaking collectively, not myself, not just Mr. Armstrong. We were interested in how to resolve the problem of waste and trash in general. How to resolve the problem of composting. Because that was the simplest way. Mr. Armstrong wanted to be sure that students had as much as possible raw milk available. He was interested in the health of students to the point, and faculty for that matter, that we even, as late as my wife's time, 1950, were looking to see whether indeed we should have an agricultural program, as we ultimately did in Britain and then in Big Sandy. Were you on any of those visits to other areas in Southern California? All right, then that was probably 48 and 49 and into 50. That is years 1, 2, and 3. Almost certainly you would have been on it because the students